This is Monday the 26th of March. Simon, can you remember the first time you came down here?
I can vaguely remember coming in the winter when it was very cold and very muddy and very difficult to walk on site because the earth would stick to your boots and weigh you down.
Did that mean that you started to feel in a certain way about this landscape because of that first day?
Well, immediately you felt you had an understanding of it because it was physically attaching itself to you, even though it was the soles of your boots. What was, really interesting was you're looking at this surface material of the landscape, which was this red earth, and you're walking in it and you suddenly found that this stuff was incredibly sticky and quite unlike other sorts of materials I've seen. The soils of the same kind of colour. This stuff was really quite specific.
What was it?
Well, it's a loam. So to me, it's something that is becoming clay, but still has an earth-like quality.
So that first day when you came down here, I mean, there's a lot of chalk here, and there's loam. So what are the colours that come off this landscape into the human eye, the first impression of it you have?
Well, the strongest immediate impression is this paleness, because the topsoil has been stripped off and you're back to the chalk bedrock. But overlaying that in certain patches is this kind of red loam that's obviously come down the hill and lies in patches on top of the white chalk. So you get this very strong...
Start again. See again.
So you get the red loam that's actually come down the hill and lies in patches on top of the white chalk.
As the days have gone on and you've been to the site on a number of days now, possibly even as many as a dozen, do you feel that the landscape has changed in front of your eyes each time you come down?
The landscape has been physically changed by the people working on the site. So it's been physically changed by the archaeologists and it's been physically changed by the road builders.
How do you feel about the way in which it's been changed by them?
Well, it's incredibly surprising to see landscape, which we imagine is something that is enduring and is one of our references of things that don't change, actually changing really fast. So if I come on Tuesday and I don't come back till Friday, I feel an anxiety that something will have gone or I will have missed something.
What is it about your own professional training and your own work that you do that causes that feeling to happen in you? Do you think you'd feel like that whether or not you were an artist, whether or not that you were interested in archaeology and in landscape? Or is it those things?
I think if this was my local landscape, if I lived here and I felt that I was defined by my landscape, which in fact we are, and I felt that that landscape was being radically changed and reshaped around me, it would create not something much more than interest, a kind of real anxiety to understand what these changes meant to me. How did they alter my, what I saw and the landscape I responded to and the landscape I existed in.
You make it sound, or rather I hear you to say, that if one responds to that anxiety by trying to understand what is happening, one can allay the anxiety, and that understanding changes to landscape is what everybody needs to do in order not, for example, to see the arrival of the railways in the 19th century or the arrival of the new motorway in the 21st century as a gaping wound that has just been gashed through the English country garden. Do you think that there's a relationship between understanding and anxiety in that way?
I think there's a complete relationship. I think you can come to terms with notions of change by recognising that, first of all, change has happened and has always taken place throughout history. That for some reason, the time we live in is no different from times that have existed. And that to be able to place oneself within a kind of a consciousness that we are all within a sense of continuity, which is something I've learnt from archaeology, actually makes you feel that you're part of, you know, the larger events that take place around you, and actually these things don't necessarily detract from you. Of course they change things, you know, the place will change and it will look different, and we need things to change, and it doesn't necessarily mean that we're excluded or it's detrimental to us all the time. It doesn't have to be detrimental, as long as we understand that this is something that has always taken place. It's a need that's always being satisfied. The landscape reflects what we need and changes as our needs change.
So what do you say to people who say, including archaeologists on this site, we need another road like a hole in the head? How do you relate
to that? I'm looking at this more on a kind of philosophical point of view. I mean, I tend to agree. It would be much better if we didn't have the road. We need it, and we have to come to terms with it. We also have to come to terms with the extent to which we need it and question that. We can't just accept we need another road. We need to understand how many roads we need and exactly where they go, and use the sensitivity about where they go and how many there are, which is something that is born from a sensitivity in terms of understanding the landscape in the first place.
You talk about the way in which the changing of the landscape, the rapid changing, the unnaturally rapid changing of the landscape in this site affects your feelings. I remember going to lectures by that great writer on the country, Raymond Williams, and he used to talk about people like Jane Austen and Thomas Hardy. He used to talk about the structure of feeling in those books, and quite often he was talking about the structure of feeling within a little community or within a family or even within an individual person. I wonder to what extent the structure of your feeling is changed not only by the dramatic speed at which this landscape is being changed, but also because we're talking about a time reference goes right back to the Neolithic and includes the Bronze Age, includes the Roman times, early medieval times, and so on.
The structure of my feeling. Well, the only way I could understand that is to be aware of how I perceive landscape and in what order I perceive things and what that order leads me to.
Are you talking about chronological order?
No, I'm talking about perceptual order. In other words, you arrive at a place and maybe you become aware of the particular, the light is something really striking, the quality of light. If I go to another country, I'm immediately aware of the difference in the quality of light, and I'm also immediately aware in the difference in smell. Right, that's the very immediate perceptual kind of activity. And then there are other things. The nature of the landscape, its particular characteristics, its shape, its soil, you know, all the things that make it specific to a place and different from another. Now, all those things gradually inform you, not all at the same time. You become aware of things in a kind of order, or I do. And I'm aware that actually a kind of ordering leads to a sense of understanding and maybe a sense of being able to position myself and understand where I am in relation to that landscape because of the order in which I receive the information. If it's turned upside down, then it's unsettling. I mean, if you come to an excavation where, you know, on one hand you're watching people incredibly carefully studying tiny little areas of earth and little pits and little indentations in the earth, and it's all about this sensitivity to microscopic detail. And on the other hand, you're watching some machine hack out tons of chalk bedrock, you know, with a claw, which is the extreme opposite. You know, it creates a very sort of strange kind of way of understanding landscape, because these are both still forms of the material landscape being used by us.
So what can you do in order yourself, when you go on this site and you have the advantage of being able to go onto this site, of allaying your anxiety by understanding? To what extent, for example, is going around picking up flints a way of allaying your anxiety by improving your understanding? Why do you pick up flints?
Why do I pick up flints? Because I, like everybody, when I'm on the beach or when I'm in a place where it's full of little stones or rocks, you're attracted to certain stones or rocks of a particular shape, and you begin a spontaneous collection. we all do it. And I've suddenly thought, actually, that's something so British or even English or whatever, or this is what we do. And I'm thinking, well, I might just do that and see if I can find a way of making that into some kind of artwork as something very specific.
But the difference between
our culture, our activities, something very, very common and an activity that we all do when we go into the landscape.
But there's a difference between picking up flints on a beach, and the beach is probably only going to be changed by the tide, and picking up flints on this site, John.
Well, the difference picking up flints on this site, as I've realised, because I certainly didn't realise when I bent down for the first time, was, in a way, I'm picking up a piece of landscape and taking it somewhere else, because if it remains here, it's going to be underneath a six-lane motorway, and it will remain there for as long as the motorway remains there.
And when I picked up a piece of flint, because I was hoping to be helping you by saying, here's one, you said, no, that's no good, it's broken.
Well, of course, I'm really fussy. They have to be particular.
And why is it so important that flints look like things, they have shapes and remind you of Henry Moore sculptures and so on? What's important about that? Why can't
bits of flint? Well, what's nice about, well, flint, as we know, I mean, for instance, in archaeology, it's a kind of key signifier of a particular time, Neolithic, when people used flints for tools. So flints can be these incredibly sharp, razor-like instruments used for stripping meat off bone. And at the same time, they can be these slug-like forms that absolutely fit perfectly into your hand. And you want to walk around holding one all day because it seems to be made for your hand. And yet it's not. It's a piece of landscape.
But it's a way of getting into some kind of tactile contact with what archaeologists at least used to call man the toolmaker. Man the maker of flint axes, which goes back beyond the Neolithic into the Paleolithic, in fact.
Well, whatever. I mean, I think it seems to me to be just a way of making sure that your contact with the landscape when you're in it has a physical dimension.
What about your contact with this site each day we come down? And one of the first things you want to do is to walk about to see what's changed from when we were there before.
Yeah, but for me, when I walk up, you know, the archaeological site, the excavation site, it's like an exhibition. I mean, to me, they are extraordinary sculptural environments. It's not really about image, it's much more about three-dimensional sculptural form. And when the holes, you know, the excavated pits and the trenches, which apparently are so mundane and, you know, they are the kind of bread and butter of British archaeology, for me, they're extraordinary three-dimensional forms. They're always varied, they're always, there's something about them that is kind of really intriguing and attracts my attention on a level in terms of appreciating form, as I do when I look at sculpture.
Can you describe one to me? My favourite is the lunette, that shape. What's yours?
There's one pit which I really enjoyed, because to sit by it was to be connected with a sense of history in such a powerful way. And it was a half-excavated circular pit, so it was a half, you know, again, it was a kind of half moon shape. But the inner, the fill inside it was this kind of clay, but really pitted and full of stone. So it was an incredibly physical surface that led you down into the bottom of the pit, which was probably about 2 meters into the ground. So to look down that thing was to look into history for me. And it's such a powerful relationship between form and material. And to me, this is what good sculpture is all about. You know, the relationship between the form and the material and the audience response to it. And, you know, in the case of a pit, which I look at as a piece of sculpture, that it brings me to understand myself in relation to time, seems to me one of the most powerful things that, well, art has been able to do. And it's a sense that I've actually seen really, felt really, really keenly on an archaeological excavation.
So in a way, you could say, listening to you, it's as though you feel that when this is tarmacked over in 3 weeks' time, it's not just the paleo-social heritage which is going to be tarmacked over and sealed in forever, but also an artistic and sculptural heritage?
Well, no, that's probably going too far, because that's my very individual kind of way of looking at it.
I know.
I mean, the reason why I want to be here on Tuesday and then on Thursday and and if I miss a week, I'm desperate, you know, I'm kind of anxious what will happen, is because this exhibition will have changed massively. You know, maybe my favourite things won't be there anymore. And often they're not, but sometimes there are new things.
Unlike any other exhibition, which tends to stay the same from the opening day to the closing day, this exhibition
well, that's
gets
the
changed during the night, sort of thing.
Well, this is landscape, this is a living thing, and actually we are playing out our interests on it. And one of those interests is archaeology. You know, it's the questions that we have about the past that are being asked here. We're not really answering what it was like to live here 2,000 years ago.
How has your relationship been advanced or taken off in maybe in a new direction or consolidated by these latest days on this site? Because you as an artist have had a relationship with archaeology before you came here. What has this site given you in the way of your relationship as an artist to archaeology, do you think?
I think what's happening really with this site is that I'm learning that it's possible to be more direct in terms of recognising what's expressive and how you actually use that.
Can you give me an example of how that's come about for you?
Well, the example is, initially when I began to work with archaeology, I used photography, which is a kind of a mediated way of looking at surface archaeological surfaces. And then I made work directly using the chalk surface from an excavation. Now I think, actually, maybe one of the most direct things on an archaeological site is the archaeologist, and I want to hear something coming out of their mouth. I want what they say to be a direct record or expressive way of talking about landscape. So to the actual person now who works with this landscape has, you know, it's become clear to me that to be direct is to actually to be looking at them.
Whereas the word mediated, which you use to photography, is an indirect way of looking at something, is it? Do you mean...
It's mediated, you know, there's something between the actual surface and the artwork, and that is photography.
But that prevents us some... That is, in a way, although it's an enabling thing, it enables you to take a picture and take the picture away, it also somehow gets in the way of the direct relationship between the observer and the observed, do you think?
Well, it puts another thing in between, which is photography, and with its own history and its own strengths and weaknesses, and my ability to be good with photography or to be bad with photography, all those things come between what I felt on site and what I put in an exhibition, which was a reference to that site.
So which was?
Which was a reference to that site.
So if I had been sent down by you because you had broken your leg and couldn't drive your car and weren't able to come down and see the site at all, but you sent me down with a bloody good camera and I took lots and lots of photographs and then brought them back to you and said to you, this landscape is like this. As you have seen this site for many, many days, what would you know those photographs had missed?
What those photographs would miss is everything that's to do with the physical dimension of landscape, which is, when I talk about the way that we perceive, first of all, there's the eye, and then the eye, you know, informs the brain about certain aspects of the way things look, that the appearance, superficial, the surface, and then there's a relationship which is on a physical level, which is about an apprehension which is direct to do with touch, you know, and there's also, of course, there's sound and the way that we hear things and the weather and how that affects us in its physicality. What a photograph will do is it will tell me what something looks like. It will give me a sense of its appearance. It has to be a very, very damn good photograph to do more than that. So a photograph will go so far, and actually there are certain strengths about using photography at certain times, but what I'm really interested in is how do we get at all this information that we have all the time, that we're processing all the time, which is to do with our physical relationship with landscape and with places, that for some reason we don't call on that information, yet we have it. We're continually actually experiencing it.
Why do you think it is?
Well, I mean, certainly in art, I mean, this is my, you know, this is the point of view that I'm talking from. That within art there is an emphasis on image making and representation. And these are things that are considered to be significant and important within art making. Now, of course, there are other kinds of forms of art making which are to do with calling attention of the body, and this is we normally associate with sculpture. But since I'm a painter, I'm really interested in how it's possible to make works which employ all the senses. So it's the eye, and it's also how the body is brought into the equation, and how at a certain point the body actually understands more than the eye is able to understand, because it's about connecting on a different level. It's no longer just about appearance. Now, these are things I've really understood are experiences that you have, or I have had, in landscape. And they provide a model for me of what art could do.
So actually, listening to that, it sounds to me, and I remember a conversation we had in the car going home the other night, that to record what an archaeological site contains in every possible way and then cover it over with a road does not transmit to future generations what it is really like. The only way that it would transmit to future generations like is if it weren't covered over but left open for people to visit in perpetuity.
But we can't do that. We do keep some sites, but even they, I think, there's something really quite false actually about a public archaeological site that's kind of, it's an artificial environment where we're allowed to see into a notion of the past. There's something about, you know, an Iron Age storage pit that's just been emptied.
What about
it's the first time light has hit that bit of ground since the person actually hacked it out of the ground 2,000 years ago. There's something really significant there. Now, of course, we can't all expect that everyone should have these kinds of experiences, but I think what is important is that how do we learn to recognise that ideas about our relationship to the past, our relationship to landscape and how landscape tells us about the past, actually puts us in a much better position today. It's not all about the past, it's actually about the present and how we deal with that.
So maybe that's why, final question, nothing less than archaeology working hand in hand with art is really going to provide the best second best to leaving the site open and not tarmacking it over, because that isn't possible. It is only by the involvement of people like you that the physical dimension can be somehow transmitted in the way in which, for example, art mediates between archaeology and the site that the archaeologists are working on, for example.
Well, I don't really think actually that what I'm trying to do is necessarily serve something that archaeology is serving. I think why I'm interested in it is because it gives me access to thinking and experiences that relate to much bigger issues, which are to do with our relationship to landscape. Archaeology gives me that access. It's such a broad discipline, it can do that. And I think what I'm actually really interested in is how do we actually give ourselves the opportunity in our lives to have experiences which are to do with all of our senses working at the same time. So a very fulfilling and rich kind of experience. Now, these are things that, you know, if we begin to be aware that actually the way that we live or the way that we operate most of the time is by prioritizing one sense over another, then I think we can be aware that maybe what could be desirable is another way of thinking, which is about allowing everything to operate all at the same time. Now, as an artist, I would like to think that maybe my artworks are communicating on a level that's suggesting that that is a good way to be responding to the world. So I think that's probably it, really.
Thank you very much.
Thank you, Graham.
There must be something in there.
I don't know what we can use it for, but there's...